Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, and with me is my great friend and co-book group member, Jan Fielden. Jan and I are going to talk about a book that we read for our book group. The memories of it have sort of stayed with us. And it's called All the Light We Cannot See. It's by an author called Anthony Doerr, D-O-E-R-R. He's an American writer, and this book won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 2015. It's a war story, Jan, but I, you know, when somebody said, oh, we're going to read a war story, my heart sinks not again. But this is a war story with a difference.
A war story with a different, with an interesting subplot of something which is quite extraordinary that weaves its way through, doesn't it?
One of the main characters, it's a story where there are two separate plots that come together in a very cunning way. And one of the main protagonists in the book is a blind girl called Marie-Laure Leblanc.
The beginning of the book, she's only six, of course, and not blind. She doesn't become blind until she's six.
No.
And it slowly, slowly takes her over.
And she has this amazing father who, because he knows that she's going to go blind, he prepares her by making a scaled model of the area where she lives in Paris. And she can feel each building and therefore learn her way around the neighbourhood.
Yes, he makes the model so detailed. Every individual house, but also all the manhole covers, the drain covers. She counts, in order to get to the corner of the road, she knows, I don't know how many it is, but she has to count five drain covers. And then she turns the corner and then there's things she can feel all the way along.
The model is a miniature of the city she kneels within and contains scale replicas of the hundreds of houses and shops and hotels within its walls. There's the cathedral with its perforated spire, and the bulky old Chateau de Saint-Malo, and row after row of seaside mansions studded with chimneys. A slender wooden jetty arcs out from a beach called the Plage de Molle. A delicate, reticulated atrium vaults over the seafood market. Minute benches, the smallest no larger than apple seeds, dot the tiny public squares. Marie-Laure runs her fingertips along the centimetre-wide parapet crowning the ramparts, drawing an uneven star shape around the entire model. She finds the opening atop the walls, where four ceremonial cannons point to sea. Bastion de la Hollande, she whispers, and her fingers walk down a little staircase. Rue des Cordières, Rue Jacques-Cartier.
She has the most amazing relationship with her father, Daniel, doesn't she? He is the sort of holder of the keys at the local natural history museum in Paris.
Mm.
And he often takes her to work with him.
And makes the locks and creates weird and wonderful places to hide things and lock them up and in their archives, in their safes underneath, isn't he? And there's a family there, isn't there? All his colleagues know Marie-Laure.
They do, and they become her family too.
Mm. But because she hasn't got a mother.
And this is all before the war breaks out, but the build-up is coming. You can feel the tension and you know that something is going to happen. It is a complicated plot, actually, because Daniel's post at the museum involves looking after this priceless diamond.
That's the subplot.
Yes.
It's the story of the priceless diamond, yes.
Which is blue but has a centre of
fire.
And he conjures up such pictures, as you said to Anthony Doerr, doesn't he, in the way he writes. But when war breaks out, the dilemma then is, as they're going to be invaded by the Germans, what will happen to...
As all the museums had to do is to hide their artefacts, hide their stuff. So some of it's all put in crates and boxes and locked and hidden and stowed and stashed in a rush, really.
And then the diamond, that's the big question.
But that's the big problem. Because
what will happen?
And the diamond has been spoken about already, hasn't it? By one of the professors explains to Marie-Laure about this secret diamond, because she's got wind of this. And she says, what is this diamond? And he explains, and it has legends attached to it, that anyone who has holds the diamond or possesses the diamond will have good luck all their life and live forever or live for a very long time. But their family and friends around them will have very bad luck.
Will be cursed, yes. So they make three replicas of this diamond. And so there are four versions of it, only one of which is the real one.
Mm.
And of course, the Germans, when they arrive in Paris, want to find the diamonds. And Daniel is given custody of one of them. He doesn't know whether it's the real one or not.
They're scattered amongst four people. Mm. And none of them know who's got the real thing.
And then he, Daniel, and his daughter Marie-Laure have to leave Paris as the Germans invade. They have to get out. And they head to
Saint-Malo.
Which is a whole other life, really.
They go to Saint-Malo because of Uncle Etienne, who is Daniel's uncle. And there we behold an amazing household, don't we? A big, tall house with the housekeeper, Madame Menac, who is capable and big hands, makes delicious food out of nothing because already the rationing's coming in and taking a grip. Uncle Etienne's mad and holed up in his room, but very, very keen on radios. Doesn't come out for a bit to say hello, does he? But once he does, he falls for Marie-Laure.
And then Marie-Laure, having learnt her way around Paris through this model that her father created for her.
He makes, and slowly, Daniel Leblanc, the dad, his task is to make a new model of Saint-Malo for Marie-Laure. But he takes ages finishing it. I think he takes about a year to do it. It's so detailed. And so she's not allowed out until the model's finished.
And she's able then to feel her way around it. Then parallel to this, we have the other plot, as it were, of the book, which involves an orphan boy called Werner Pfennig. He and his sister Jutta are living in a very poor area of Germany.
Essen, in the mining area, isn't it?
Yes, very bleak. And actually, he would have been sent down the mine.
His father died in the mines and he would have been sent down. It's his big dread that he will go down the mines, but it seems to him inevitable. Until, because he's so amazingly good with radios and wires and plugs and inquisitive, he finds out how things work, doesn't he? Right,
he
from being a tiny little boy. And that comes to the attention of the German authorities.
But he actually makes a little radio. Transistor radio, doesn't he? And he and his sister Jutta pick up...
Oh, yes, this is a connection.
...in the evening, this transmission from they don't know where.
But it entrances them.
Yes, on science. And it intrigues him so much, Werner, that he makes it his business to just investigate more and more and more. And, of course, they live with Frau Elena, who has taken them in, basically.
Runs a little tiny orphanage, really, for mining children. It becomes known that he's very, very good at radios and mending them because he just sits and looks at them for ages and can see where there is a faulty connection or where the resistor doesn't connect to the whatever this is. It's very technical, brilliant research. Anthony Durr's knowledge.
But it isn't long before Werner comes to the notice of the German authorities. And in fact, there's quite a tense part of the book where he and Jutta and the other children are sitting at supper.
A knock after curfew. Werner and Jutta are doing schoolwork with a half dozen other children at the long wooden table. Frau Elena pins her party insignia through her label before opening the door. A lance corporal with a pistol on his belt and a swastika band on his left arm steps in from the rain. Beneath the low ceiling of the room, the man looks absurdly tall. Werner thinks of the shortwave radio tucked into the old wooden first aid cabinet beneath his cot. He thinks, they know. The lance corporal looks around the room, the coal stove, the hanging laundry, the undersized children, with equal measures of condescension and hostility. His handgun is black. It seems to draw all the light in the room toward it. Werner risks a single glance at his sister. Her attention stays fixed on the visitor. The corporal picks up a book from the parlour table, a children's book about a talking train, and turns every one of its pages before dropping it. Then he says something that Werner can't hear. Frau Elena folds her hands over her apron, and Werner can see she's done so to keep them from shaking. Werner, she calls in a slow, dreamlike voice, without taking her eyes from the corporal. This man says he has a wireless in need of... Bring your tools, the man says.
I think one of the things that Anthony Doerr is really good at is building tension in this book, isn't he?
Yes, because the tension's already there, even before, a little bit. The tension's been built up before the German officer comes round, because they've got the couple of the orphans in the little house have joined Hitler Youth, haven't they? They're getting pretty brainwashed, really, there, and Frau Eleanor doesn't like it, nor does Jutta, nor does Werner. Mm. They haven't got minds of their own. They're being swamped by the rules and regulations and joining up. But they hide their armbands, I remember reading, under their shirts, so that Frau Eleanor doesn't notice, but I think Werner knows.
And it isn't long before Werner's talents are then taken on by the authorities, and he's sent away to this ghastly sort of academy to raise the...
Was it Schultzforter or something?
Yeah, well, it's quite scary.
And that's another amazing picture that the author paints. You know, this freezing cold boarding school with icicles hanging from every...
In a building that sounds somewhat familiar to Dracula's castle
or
something awful like that.
Bullying, well, not guards, teachers. Except relationships are made, aren't they?
It's a very tough time, though, isn't it? And he's made to work again in the evenings and any spare time that he has.
He works with a sort of physics professor. Mm. And of course, these are the opportunities Werner wants. He knows in his heart he doesn't really like the school and what it's training them to do, but he's grabbing hungrily, isn't he, the opportunity to learn about electronics or electrics or whatever, the physics of it all.
Well, it was an escape for him, wasn't it?
And it's using this curiosity which burns in his head.
But an escape to what? I mean, he gets taken
into the war effort
and goes to Russia.
And I think he has a battle with his conscience all the while, because he's got a friend called Frederick, who's the one who actually never quite gives in.
Yes.
He refuses to do some of the things and is damaged for, he's punished so severely, I won't give a game away. And that makes Werner think. He thinks, he knows that he's weak in a way. Good, lovely man, but he's weak.
So you have these two paths of the novel in a way, that the radio is what links the two. So it's Etienne who is in Saint-Malo, who was actually doing the broadcast.
Linked,
maybe first.
I'm being a bit fanciful, but linked too by the fact that though they're far away and don't know each other, and that's the link, but it's also the link that they're both looking for something and discovering.
Yes.
Marie-Laure is feeling her way around, and he's feeling his way along the radios, and how do I do this? What does this mean? What do these wires mean? It's very interesting paralleling, I think.
They're both isolated children. She is isolated by being blind and evacuated, if you like, to Saint-Malo.
Yeah.
And he is totally isolated because he's picked apart from the rest of them to specialise in radios. And he then, Werner, gets taken on by the army, and they advance into Russia, where his work is actually detecting
the source of enemy radios.
Yes. But the conditions in which he's having to work are dire. Cold, bleak, dangerous, and hardly a friend.
Hardly a friend is a curious character. I think Anthony Doerr all along draws these amazing characters.
Yes.
Not necessarily the two protagonists, but the big soldier, who's a vicious brute of a man. No compunction about killing anyone who gets in his way. And yet he has a softness for Werner.
Volkheimer isn't his name. Sounds like something out of Harry Potter, doesn't it?
Yeah, or Wagner or something. Yes, well, it does Harry Potter. That's quite interesting in the novel. Nothing's ever quite black or white, is it?
No. And then the other strand of it is, of course, the diamond. And there comes this Sergeant Major Reinhold von Rumpel, who is a sergeant major and gemologist in the German army. And it's his task to track down the one real
one.
Diamond. And so he goes off on the trail of all the
And it also replicas. Becomes a personal quest for him, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because he's fighting against
he's
his
terminally
health.
Ill. Yes. And anyway, suffice to say, all paths converge in Saint-Malo. And it's a very tense ending, isn't it? I must say, there is at one point von Rumpel, the army officer, the gemologist, gets into the house where Marie-Laure is actually hiding, and we know the diamond is there. And
it is a real heart-beating feeling of somebody after you in a house.
I couldn't put the book down at that point. I had to keep on reading. I think I didn't finish until about 2 o'clock in the morning because I needed to get past that.
It truly is a page-turner, isn't it, this book? The thing I think we missed out saying are all this fascinating material to read about, which I, you know, just about radios, about the sky, about it being inquisitive. It makes you want to be inquisitive. It's also, I think, incredibly moving, especially Marie-Laure's relationship to her father. and that he, we haven't said how he goes off. He's summoned back to the museum. He never gets there. We won't see what happens. But Mary Laws, she's lost her lifeline. And she's in this house in Saint-Malo. She still hasn't explored Saint-Malo because her father always said, stay there until I come back. And with her uncle and the housekeeper, Madame Manick, who are both lovely and love her dearly. But she has to grow up very fast and she misses him. There's a fantastic bit about when he'd gone, about how she felt her father slipping away from her as the loneliness in the house became more oppressive. Mm. It's just so sad. Very, very moving.
Because both children had to grow up. I guess a lot of people did in the war, had to grow up very quickly, far more quickly than children have to do today.
She's brave too, isn't she? She's a brave woman, Mary Law.
So it's certainly one to recommend.
Absolutely. Oh, we didn't talk about the end.
No, well,
we're not going to talk about
it. Not talk about the end, because that's the rule you do not break.
Oh, right.
You can't give away the ending, except to say that one to recommend, All the Light We Cannot See, and it's now out as an audio book. It's by Anthony Doerr, and I hope you enjoy it.
Our thanks to Caliber Audio for enabling us to use extracts from All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. The narration was by Julie Teal. The recording lasts for 17 hours. The music accompanying this edition of the Talking Bookshelf is called Good Times. It was composed and recorded by Goffby of Kenilworth, who's very generously given us permission to use his music.